Welcome back to the Secret Bunker podcast. As always, my host... As always, my name is Piers Carmichael. I'm here with...
Max Klein. And today, we have a very special guest, Sean Eli, who is a stand-up comedian who has headlined shows in 5 continents. He has performed in theaters, comedy clubs, yacht clubs, houses of worship, corporate events, private parties, and once at an embassy and a barn. Welcome to the show, Sean Eli.
Thank you. And just to clarify, there were no animals in the barn.
Was it a renovated barn or just temporarily the animals were moved from the barn?
It was neither. It was a barn that hasn't been used as a barn in a long time. And a guy who has the barn in his yard has parties in it.
Nice.
We're super, super excited to have you here.
I'm happy to be here.
Our first guest of season 2. This is great.
Yeah, the hell with season 1.
Exactly. Now that season 2 has started, season 1 was terrible. Season 2 is the way to go.
And season 3, I don't like season 3 either.
Season 2 was the peak, I think.
Yeah.
I think history will say we peaked in season 2. Season 3, the Spotify deal, they really sold out in season 3.
Yeah, we're taking the Joe Rogan route.
Yeah, the money ruined you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For real. Let's get into it. To start, I want to get your opinion on this question. Are people born funny, or is it like a skill that's built over time?
I think it's both. I think kids are funny. If you look at little kids playing, they're laughing all the time. I think what happens is, if you're funny enough and you're the class clown, you get funny beat out of you by teachers and parents who tell you, you know, pay attention and shut up. So by the time you're an adult, people have learned to try to stifle that instinct. But so I think a lot of people are funny. I think you can certainly hone comedy writing ability.
I think I agree with you that at school, people tend to like be very outgoing in the beginning and like slowly shut themselves down as they get older.
Yeah, screw that puberty thing. That causes all the problems.
Or like just stop themselves from, you know, shutting themselves off and like being less, you know, outgoing, less, you know, more less willing to share.
Currently, my day job is I'm a PE teacher for 9 to 12 year olds. And some of them are very funny.
Yeah, but if they interfere and the teacher says, you know, maybe less in PE than in, say, math class. If a kid makes a wise-ass comment, the teacher's attitude is probably, hey, that's detracting from my message. So the teacher doesn't want that.
They say shut up and pay attention.
Yeah.
And people learn, oh, the right thing to do is to shut up and pay attention, not be funny.
I had a day job and my boss appreciated my sense of humor, but he would say whenever he said something, he could see the gears turning in my head where I was less paying attention to him and looking for a punchline.
I've definitely been there, though. You're kind of listening to what someone's saying, but you're also kind of just picking it apart, trying to find something to make fun of or to laugh at.
Yeah.
Why do you choose to make clean comedy?
Well, 2 reasons. One is I tend not to write dirty jokes. Like, things that occur to me are usually not dirty jokes. So when I started in comedy, I took a class and they said, if you can be clean, you're better off, because nobody ever got fired for not being dirty enough, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're clean, there's places you can work that you can't work if you're dirty. And from a business standpoint, comedy clubs don't care, but comedy clubs don't pay well, because the star of a comedy club show generally is the club. Mm-hmm. People usually go to a club not knowing who's going to be there. Or if they do, it's still not somebody famous enough, because by the time you're big enough that people have heard of you, you're not working in comedy clubs, you're working in bigger venues. But if you want corporate events or charity events where the money is, being dirty doesn't get you booked. That said, I'm sure Dave Attell and Jim Norton are hilarious and make great livings, but they're the rarity.
Definitely.
You have a background in finance, right?
Yeah, for probably almost 20 years.
That's very impressive.
How did you make the switch from finance to comedy? Is there anything from finance that you've brought into your comedy?
Well, I made the switch gradually because... You think about it, nobody becomes a comedian overnight. Just like if you play an instrument or a sport, you don't start out good. You have to learn it. The difference is, for those things, you're learning as a kid, right? And by the time you're an adult, if you've been doing it for 15 years, you're good. But a comedian, people don't start. I mean, you may be telling jokes all the time as a 5-year-old, but as somebody who writes and performs in front of an audience, it's a different skill. And if you don't start that as an adult, you don't start out good. So you make a gradual transition. You have to have a day job or a source of income or a couch or basement to sleep in while you hone comedy.
Was there a moment where you like suddenly decided to start pursuing comedy as like as a main career?
I don't remember a specific moment where I said screw banking, but I realized I essentially had two jobs. I had a day job, and then in the evening I was doing stand-up comedy, and as I started to get paid for it, not a lot, but I said, you know what? This is too much. I can't do both. It's too much time. I want to have a life. I got to get rid of something. And I got rid of the lucrative one in favor of the desirable one.
That's a decision that I have a lot of respect for. I really do. It takes a lot of courage to do that. And I mean, I'm a film major in college, and I'm a big believer in my own philosophy is like really do what makes you happy. And money is not what makes you happy in life in the end of the day.
We're not the same generation. I'm probably around your parents' age, which probably doesn't do well to remind people of that. But my parents are 40 years older than I am, and they lived through the Depression, and to them, financial security was the most important thing, and nothing else mattered, because if you were hungry, you had a major problem.
Definitely.
It's true, but I grew up middle class, and I take financial security for granted. I don't think about it. I figure I have a skill, I have brains, I'm not a moron. I'll always have some sort of job, and if I lose my job, even if it takes me a year, I'll find another one. So I was less concerned with financial security and more concerned with happiness.
That's a really good point. I've never thought of it that way.
That's the way you're looking at it. You're like, as long as I have enough money that I'm not hungry, that everything else is less important.
I like the way you phrase that, though. If you don't have food, you have a serious problem. Like, well, yes.
It's like, as long as your survival needs are met and you're not, you know, struggling to survive, then you can essentially keep living and do what you want to do.
Well, I mean, my mother was seriously poor as a kid. Like missing meals, you know, a day or two in a row, poor. And she said when she was a kid, she thought, well, if you're rich, you have no problems. And then, of course, as she grew up, she realized that wasn't true. But I'm thinking that's not true. If you're rich, you have problems, but they pale in comparison to poor people's problems.
Yeah.
Somebody did a study about 15 years ago. And I don't remember how they measured this or what the details were. And it was only one. But they decided that happiness increases with income to, at the time, about $75,000. And after you earn more than $75,000, you didn't get happier as your income went up.
I've seen the same study.
That definitely makes sense, because that seems like about the bar where, like, you know, you are financially comfortable, and anything more than that is, you know, wealth that can hypothetically be spent on whatever you want.
Right. If you go from, you think about it this way, people say now experiences are better to spend money on than material things because you get used to material things. So if you go from a Honda to a Lexus, you feel good, your car is better, and then you get used to the Lexus, and now it's just your car.
I feel like you can almost compare it to drug addiction in a way. People, like, you know, they get that hit of dopamine, that, you know, that excitement, that rush of adrenaline when they buy something new, and then that fades after it's no longer new. And in order to keep, you know, feeling that, you have to keep buying something new. And, you know, it would have to either be more and more expensive, or you lose the thrill of it, and it doesn't become a big deal anymore.
You turn in your 10-year-old Honda for a new Lexus. When your Lexus is 3 years old and you buy a new one, that's not a big change.
Call me a soulless capitalist, but I just bought my a new SodaStream, and it's made my life maybe 2-3 times better. I drink sparkling water every day. It's fantastic. So, I mean, I want to defend consumerism here a little bit.
Can you see the bubbles in my glass? I bought a SodaStream, I don't know, pretty close to 10 years ago, I guess, and I love it.
Is it the, like, longer, more square-shaped one with this, like, rounded at the top and bottom?
Yeah.
My parents have the same ones, yeah.
Mine is blue.
I think mine's black and white.
Yeah, the black and white one, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's the same one I have back home. But I'm the one who got Piers on the SodaStream grind, because I feel like it's really awesome.
Well, I used to drink a lot of soda. I used to drink a lot of Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi, and I started drinking seltzer, and I weaned myself off of soda. And now I started in the pandemic drinking a little bit, but I dilute it with seltzer from the SodaStream. That is something I still do appreciate every day, because I probably drink 3 bottles of sparkling water a day.
I mean, yes, follow your passion. Yes, you know, reach fulfillment. But also, you got to get a SodaStream.
You could also argue that the SodaStream falls under that $75,000 line limit, and it still falls in line with the theory.
Okay, fair.
Well, you know, it's weird, though, because I was just before the pandemic, I was touring internationally, and I was in Thailand, and you can't drink the tap water in Thailand, so you have to go into a store and buy it. And the hotels would give you a couple of little bottles of water a day for, you know, brushing your teeth and that sort of thing. But I drink a lot of water and seltzer, and I would go into a convenience store and I'd buy a bottle of seltzer. And it's weird to me, even though it's dirt cheap, you know, it might be 35 cents for a bottle, I felt weird paying for it.
Yeah.
Because I have it for free at home.
It feels like you're paying for a premium.
Here's a question. On your website, it says you make Trump jokes. What do you think are the right and the wrong ways to do funny Trump comedy?
Here's the thing. When I started in comedy, I thought about doing political comedy. And I realized you piss off half the audience if you do political comedy. And people aren't laugh. People don't like to laugh at jokes that make fun of stuff they believe in. And even in, let's say, New York, which might be 60% not Trump and 40% Trump, you're still going to piss off 40% of the audience. So I stopped. And also, you got to rewrite your jokes constantly because things are changing. So I opted out of being a political comedian. That said, on places like Facebook, if I think of something political and funny, I'll post it. But touring the world, I discovered that when people, during the Trump administration, when people heard I was an American, they were curious about my politics. So I had to get that out of the way up front.
And how did you do that?
In South Africa, they had just fired their former president for corruption. And I said, I'm an American, I'm happy to be here, but I'm happy to be in any country that gets rid of its corrupt effing presidents.
It definitely is a good way to break the ice. And it's interesting that, you know, outside of the country, there's kind of become this like, oh, do people in America really support Trump?
Well, during the George W. Bush administration, a lot of the world didn't like what he was doing, but they gave Americans the benefit of the doubt. They're like, he's your president, but we know it doesn't mean you support him. But I think with Trump, he went so far to one side that we get blamed for things he did, even if we didn't vote. Well, if they find out we didn't vote for him, they're fine. But they do blame the country for picking him.
What do you think is going to fill the comedic void that has been kind of, you know, left since Trump is no longer in office?
Well, I mean, for like late night TV comedians talking about politicians, there's still plenty of material. I think in a way, sometimes it was harder with Trump because he was so outrageous, you couldn't exaggerate what he did and make fun of him in that way. So I think that they're just back to normal. The problem with late night TV is the lack of an audience has really hindered the host's ability to perform. They're just not good without audiences. And I think part of that is, for the most part, they're not stand-up comedians. They don't have that background. What they have is an improv background, and it's different. And it seems so simple to me. They've got to pause. They've got to give the people at home a chance to laugh. But it's hard to do that when you don't hear laughter. So I think the move that they've all done to at least bring their staff in to be a small audience is an improvement.
Yeah, it's really hard to be funny in silence.
Can you tell us more about your tour? When did you go? How many countries did you go to?
The first tour, I went to South Africa, and that was, I think, 3 years ago. And that was really hard. They just did not get my sense of humor there. And I think of it as, you know, South Africa is a Western country. It's an English-speaking country. And my jokes are not local. I don't do jokes about, you know, TV commercials or American TV shows or anything that they may or may not have there. But it's just a different sensibility. And they explained to me during apartheid, when there were boycotts of the country and essentially embargoes, it became a very insular nationalistic country. And the South African comedians talk about South African-centric stuff. But then from there, I performed in the Netherlands and the UK and Ireland.
Wow.
And that was a different experience. And especially Ireland, somehow they loved me in Ireland. I felt like a king there.
Nice.
That's awesome.
And then Australia, New Zealand, and Thailand was the next year. That was just before the pandemic. And that went really well, too. And I want to travel more. I want to do some touring.
Do you have fans in those countries already? Or are you going there to promote yourself to new audiences?
For the most part, it's been promoting myself to new audiences. So I have an email list, and I have some people on my email list in different countries. And when I started touring, I put into my monthly email, hey, by the way, if you're in South Africa or you're in Australia or whatever, here's my schedule. And every email, until recently, every email I sent out would have a link to my schedule page. But now I don't have that. But I don't know that anybody came up to me and said, hey, I've been on your mailing list for 5 years.
Sean Eli, Thai fan club, you know, you never know. But
well,
alas, perhaps not.
It was interesting because the Thai, there's actually a full-time 7-day-a-week comedy club in Bangkok. And the audience consists of tourists who speak English and people from Thailand who are basically the wealthy class where they go to English or American schools and speak perfect English. And they're comfortable in English and go to the comedy club. And occasionally, you know, a Swedish person or a French person who speaks pretty good English will pop in as well.
Here's a question. Can you tell us about your two unfilmed Seinfeld episodes?
Yes, when the show, I was a fan of Jerry Seinfeld as a comedian. I'd seen him on The Tonight Show. And when he got the show, my college roommate and I wanted to write a spec script, an episode for the show. And I think we watched one episode maybe and quickly banged out a script and sent it to him. They're on my website, which is where you saw them. And we banged out an episode and we sent it to them. And I got the nicest rejection letter I've ever gotten from a producer named Larry Charles that basically said, we don't think this is right for the show, but who the hell are we to judge? We don't really know what we're doing. That sort of letter.
Yeah.
And I wrote a second one without my roommate, and that's the second one on my website, and that didn't get filmed either. I have a long history of trying to write for TV shows that immediately get canceled. I did not manage to cancel Seinfeld.
No, your powers did not extend. What canceled? They were canceled, so I guess we wouldn't have heard of them.
Well, no, I mean, they might have been canceled after a few seasons.
Okay.
Hill Street Blues, which is a police show, I think, in the 80s. Oh, man. Quantum Leap. I don't even know if you guys are familiar with that.
Yes.
One of you is. It's a time travel TV show that was probably in the 90s. I thought I had a good premise. The premise of the show is that the guy basically, with his knowledge, pops into the body of someone else in the past and has to fix a problem to get back to his regular life. And I popped him into the Woodstock concert. And he was the one who got Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young all to play together to solve a problem so that he could go back to where he was.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Thanks. But they canceled the show before they could use it.
So. Oh, that sucks.
Or buy it, for that matter.
Yeah.
Do you prefer doing comedy at clubs, corporate events, or some other venue that we haven't discussed yet?
Here's the thing. You go to a comedy club. It's crowded. They tell you, like, stand in the corner. Make sure you stay out of the waitress's way, and we'll call you when it's time for you to go on stage. And then you got to sometimes weave your way between narrow tables, you know, close together, a narrow aisle to get to the stage. And it's interesting because new comics learn if you can't figure out the way to the stage because all the tables are so close together, watch the MC because he knows which particular route weaving in between the tables works. You go to a theater show and you show up and there's usually a guy with a headset standing at the door. And when you show up, he says, the artists are here and they escort you to a green room, which is the size of, you know, a big living room. And they hand you menus and they say, just let us know what you want for dinner and when you want to eat it. And I mean, the difference is vast, but comics love both. Anytime we get to stand in front of a big group of people and make them laugh is wonderful. Corporate events are harder because they don't want to be there. Somebody, and I think it's a great idea to have a comedian at a corporate event. Don't get me wrong. The studies that show laughing helps you remember and makes you like the event more. But you have a long day of meetings and then dinner, and then maybe there's some speeches or an awards ceremony, and it's 9 o'clock at night and people want to go back home or they want to go back to a hotel room or whatever. And then somebody comes out and says, we have a special treat for you. Shut the hell up for a half hour because this guy's going to talk to you. And we paid him a bunch of money. People are sometimes thrilled. And some, if you're famous, they're thrilled. If you're not famous, they're like, I know he's funny, but I want to go home already. I can pick my own comedians. So that's harder.
You got to get them on board.
Yeah. But any place people want to be there is a lot of fun for a comedian. I did a show at a small comedy club on a Thursday night between Christmas and New Year's during a blizzard when, you know, people don't tend to go out. We had three people in the audience and I was a new comic and usually that would be a really hard show. But they wanted to be there and we basically just sat on the edge of the stage and talked to them for an hour and a half. And they loved it. It was a lot of fun. So all venues have their uses. And the Barn Show, by the way, was fun too.
We talked about it earlier, but tell us more about the Barn Show.
Well, there's a guy named Ben who, in the middle of a suburb, there was a barn in his backyard. I guess his house was really old and back when it was agricultural and not suburban. And they never tore the barn down and obviously couldn't keep cows in it. But he just would have a party every, I think, Friday night and his neighbors would come over. And he hired me to perform.
That's really awesome.
Yeah.
I would definitely, if I had a barn, I'd want a stand-up comedian to come and perform in it. But moving on, as a Jewish person, I'm kind of curious, how has being Jewish, like, affected or influenced your comedy?
In a lot of ways, I think. I think one of the reasons a lot of comedians are Jewish is because we're from families of storytellers. If you think about it, what is a Passover Seder? Saturday is the first night of Passover, is sitting around the table telling the story of the escape from Egypt. And every other holiday, you get a family get together and people are just telling stories. Mm-hmm. And part of it, I think, is trying to one-up people because humor is respected.
Definitely.
So I think that encourages Jews to become comedians. Also, when you're a member of an oppressed group, humor is a part of an escape from tyranny in your mind. And if you did a survey of comedians, you would see that a bunch of them are Jewish, a bunch of them are other minorities, racial minorities or other ethnic minorities. There's a lot more gay comedians than the gay population of the country as a whole, percentage-wise. What you don't have, though, there's a very big oppressed group in this country that don't typically become comedians, and that's women. But pretty much every other oppressed ethnic group, there's probably, I would guess, more Catholic comedians than Protestant comedians, or at least disproportionately high share. And there are probably not a lot of, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant heterosexual comedians. There's certainly, I mean, that's the biggest part of the population, but not the biggest part of the comedy population. And I think a lot of it is just oppression. Now, it's interesting. I do shows at synagogues, and occasionally I'll get a call from a synagogue saying, you know, we want Jewish, because I put shows together with other comedians as well. They'll say, we want Jewish comedians for a comedy show. And I say, no, you don't. You just want the best comedians for your group. And then I bring an Italian Catholic, and they'll say, oh my God, it was great. You know, it was the same family nonsense that we have, only with better food. And what I tell them is, you don't want the same person with three different faces. You don't want three of me in your comedy show. You want some variety.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I can definitely understand the synagogue coming to you and saying, we want Jewish comedians, because in their mind, they're thinking, you know, we like Jewish jokes. We like, you know, Jewish comedians will relate more to our humor.
But it's really the other way around. Mm-hmm. The audience has got to relate to the comedian.
Definitely.
And you think about it this way. If you have an audience of factory workers, they don't want three comedians who are factory workers. They want to get the hell away from the factory.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that'd be fun. You spend all day working on the factory line, then some guy comes in and he's like, so how about, you know...
How about that factory line?
Yeah.
Like, what about hammers and buttons and stuff? But, like, we have enough of this.
Yeah. Well, also, you don't want three people who are talking about the same topics. The easiest thing in the world for me to do would be to put together a show with three comedians who are all heterosexual single white males in their 40s. Because if I randomly picked comedians, that would be, you know, half of them. But you don't want that. I've actually literally been in a green room of a show where two comedians are like, how many Tinder jokes are you doing? Oh, I guess I won't do that one.
Oh, because you don't want to be laughing about the same topics.
The same. Yeah, you don't want to hear enough of this Tinder crap already.
Now we have a new segment. This segment is called...
Embarrass the hell out of the guest.
Actually, very close. This segment is called Your Thoughts On, where we have a few things that we're just going to ask you about your thoughts.
Okay.
And we'll just go from there.
Because we're curious, like, what are your thoughts on, first topic is, Bitcoin?
I've been wrong before, but I think when people buy something claiming it's a medium of exchange, but it really is just hoping somebody else is going to want it later, and it has no intrinsic value, I think that's a mistake. Now, when I was a banker, we used to lend money to sports teams, and sports teams, for the most part, lose money, but the value keeps going up. And the reason the value keeps going up is because, as I described it, there's going to be another rich idiot who's going to pay more for this team because he thinks it's cool to own a sports franchise. But that comes to a peak. At some point, you run out of rich idiots willing to pay $1 billion for a team, or they'll pay $1 billion, but they won't pay $1.2 billion. And the revenues from the teams won't keep going up because, although it has been, the TV ad revenue, which is where teams get all their money, has to reach a peak. And so I think Bitcoin makes sense as a medium of exchange, but it would be better if it were linked to a basket of currencies as opposed to just more people buying it. Because I think the issue now is almost all the, I read an article, almost all Bitcoin is owned by like 100 people. Mm. And they're not selling yet. So it's the other people trying to buy the other 1% that are making it skyrocket.
Yeah.
Because there's limited supply.
I definitely agree that the bubble for Bitcoin is definitely pretty unstable and could burst at any moment.
I disagree. I think Bitcoin's going to 100K this year. It'll be a million by 2050.
I think it's on the up and up right now, and I think people are really dumping a lot of money into it, which is why it's going up so much in value. But I mean, it's just like a stock or like anything else that is, you know, not directly linked to a physical item with the value. The value is basically just based on whatever everyone decides what it is.
Right, but a stock, you're buying something. Now, in theory, all you're buying is a partial ownership in a company and the right to vote. But and the voting in companies is BS because it's not really a democracy. But at least you have some sort of vague interest in the future cash flows of the company.
Definitely. I was more saying just on the terms of the based on like the way the pricing works is like the price is determined by how much people are willing to pay for it. And so today someone could be willing to pay $50,000 for a Bitcoin and tomorrow someone's willing to pay 1 cent.
Right. And and that's the kind of thing that could come crashing down. And it could also come crashing down if governments decide to start regulating it or follow it, because I suspect now when you have Bitcoin and you sell it, I don't know that anybody, there's no 1099 coming from your broker telling you that you sold Bitcoin, but the money's got to show up somewhere. And if it shows up in your bank account, in theory, even though the bank isn't notifying the IRS of it, somebody could, in theory, see it and say, what's this about?
Another thing is there's no regulation about, you know, there's no such thing as insider trading or anything with cryptocurrencies because there's no companies to be nefarious with. So there is a lot of, you know, pump and dump schemes and things like that that are being, you know, put out through cryptocurrency that wouldn't be allowed in stocks or other mediums that people used to try and do things like that in.
Well, Piers, did you say it was going up to $1 million?
I believe it will get to $1 million. In our lifetime.
Well, let me ask you this. I don't know the answer to this, but it's easily an internet search away. What's the total value now of all Bitcoin?
I think it's just reached a tenth of gold, so maybe 1 trillion.
1.6 trillion.
Okay. So now, and what is it, like $60,000?
Yeah.
So you're talking about it's going up 15-fold. So 15 trillion is about what? Close to the GNP of the U.S.? So you think Bitcoin is going to be equal to the whole economic output of the United States?
I think Bitcoin is going to be almost exactly equal to the market cap of gold. I think it's going to be digital gold. I think it's going to replace gold as a store of value separate from the economy. And I think gold is at around 10 trillion. And so maybe it won't get to a million. Maybe it'll get to 750,000 to get to that 10 trillion market cap. My bet is that Bitcoin will replace gold.
That's an interesting, and I can't argue with that idea, because the only reason gold is a storage of value is because people believe that it's a storage of value. Although it does at least have some rarity. You can't make gold.
Yeah.
And I know you can't quite make Bitcoin, but you can also come up with a different cryptocurrency.
You can mine for Bitcoin, though. And that's incredibly complex, but essentially you are creating...
Yeah, we can create more Bitcoin, but it gets harder and harder each time.
Yeah, and actually, they've hard-coded a limit that by the year 2140, there will be no more Bitcoins to mine. So luckily for our lifetime, there'll be more Bitcoins, but eventually there'll be a maximum Bitcoin amount of Bitcoins.
Yeah, which is 21 million.
The problem, though, is it uses a lot of computing power to mine Bitcoins. And as there are more and more Bitcoins, it uses more computing power, which uses a boatload of electricity.
Yeah, it makes it less and less profitable.
Right. Well, to make it less and less profitable and more environmentally destructive.
That too.
I think that's a totally valid criticism of Bitcoin.
Well, also, there doesn't seem to be a need for it, except for criminals and people who really believe that no country's currency is safe.
Well, one thing about Bitcoin, and one of the main questions is, why does the US allow it to exist? because Bitcoin threatens the United States' hegemony over the world reserve currency.
Well, that's a good point. Even just somebody said drug dealers are using all these $100 bills. Why don't we just cancel the currency and issue new physical currency to get that money out? And the answer is because the U.S. benefits from money under a mattress. So if there's $6 billion of money buried in Colombia from drug cartels, we got the economic value of creating the goods and services that money could represent without having to provide the goods and services because the money didn't get spent. So you're right. We don't want to lose it. A government doesn't want to lose the value of the importance of their currency, especially the U.S., because everybody uses dollars.
Let's move on to our next your thoughts on. These are all random and sometimes controversial, but we just want to hear your thoughts. What are your thoughts on Hong Kong?
I am very likely to never be able to go to China if I express my thoughts on Hong Kong. But I have to say, when the Brits gave up Hong Kong to China with the guarantee from the Chinese that they wouldn't basically make it just into China, everybody saw China meddling in Hong Kong's affairs and slowly taking over. So I believe in freedom and I believe in democracy and I don't believe in totalitarianism.
How dare you? I love totalitarianism.
Yeah. Well, if I were the dictator, I would too. I'm guessing you're from a country where there is, in theory, a monarch, although not a particular powerful one. It would have expected that as China became a world power economically and their standard of living grew, that it might have become more of a democracy, but so far that has not happened. And it's friggin' hot in Hong Kong, hot and humid in the summertime. I was there, and I always thought humidity mathematically, by the laws of physics, could not go beyond 100%, but oh my god, was it wet.
Yeah, at what point is it just, are you just swimming?
Just swimming through the air. That's kind of what it felt like.
Swimming in your clothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the next topic that we want to talk about is net neutrality.
I'm not an expert on that, but I worry that if my cable company gets to decide what I get delivered fast and what I get delivered slow, if that's a problem with net neutrality, then that gives them too much power. Because all these companies already know everything I do.
I completely agree with that. And I think we have to look long-term as well. A lot of people, the argument for why it should be, you know, taken out or whatever is because they say, oh, if we give these companies the power to do it, they won't. And, you know, democracy or corporate competition will keep them from doing it. You know, they have to compete with each other and therefore they won't do it because they have to be competitive.
That's BS. That's complete BS. Where I live, there's a cable company and a phone company, and those are the only two places you can get high-speed internet. And I live just outside of New York City, and I'm sure it's like that everywhere. And a friend of mine passed away from COVID, and I've been helping his mom out, and she was fighting with Verizon yesterday because she couldn't get through to them. And everybody she spoke to was like, oh, you got to call customer service. I'll transfer you. And then after 3 hours, she was hanging up. And I sent Verizon a Facebook message saying, she wants to cancel a service appointment. She's trying to save you money and not have you ring her doorbell at 8 o'clock in the morning. Could you please call her? And they're like, you got to do it online. I said, she doesn't have her account information. Her son set up the account and he passed away. She's 89. Don't make this 89-year-old spend all day on hold. She doesn't have a lot of days left. And they were like, oh, you got to call customer service. And I'm like, didn't you just understand you don't answer the phone?
That's horrible.
And that's with two companies. So giving the companies the power, saying the market will work, only works if I have as much power as the companies do. And I don't. That's why we have a government.
We can look at airlines. You know, they're progressively charging more and more for things, despite the fact that there's competition.
But there's not, you say competition, but it's an oligopoly with huge barriers to entry.
Yeah.
And so that's not fair competition.
Companies are getting bigger and bigger and consolidating and buying big companies. You know, AT&T Mobile just bought Sprint. AT&T just bought Time Warner. there are these huge companies that are consolidating and essentially becoming the modern day, you know,
oligarchs,
Rockefellers and, you know, big trusts of the past.
Well, here's a weird thing. In New York City, there are three AM news stations. I know this is not the internet, but there's three AM news stations. Two are owned by the same company, and the third one was owned by the guy who was the mayor at the time. And if you look at the time, you know, there were four TV networks, broadcast TV networks. NBC at the time was owned by GE, which was a military contractor. CBS was owned by an entertainment company. ABC was also owned by an entertainment company. And Fox was basically controlled by a very conservative family that immigrated to the U.S. from Australia. It used to be you could only own five radio or TV stations. And that rule went away, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago. And now there's been so much merger and so much acquisition in the media that just a few companies control almost everything. And I have a cable. This is something I thought would be a bigger problem, but I don't pay that much for internet. And I have a 200 megabit per second internet connection speed. So if they said to me, we have to charge you more because you spend so much time, you know, using bandwidth on YouTube or video games or whatever, I would understand that. But for them to just have the power to decide essentially what I can watch is a problem.
Mm-hmm. Or even, they have so much incentive to change things too. Like AT&T just bought Time Warner and that, you know, the whole Warner Brothers section under that, which means they own HBO and HBO Max. Right. Now they have a streaming service that's competing with Netflix. They have a lot of incentive to slow Netflix down and make their platform more appealing.
Right, or Disney Plus is going to be a little slower.
Just 5% slower. Just a little bit.
Well, or they'll say, you know, we don't like Google. Google is our competitor, and YouTube is owned by Google, so we're going to slow down YouTube and speed up Vimeo or whatever competes with YouTube. It's basically allowing a car company to say, well, you know, our car will run a little bit better on that other gasoline. Now you got to buy gasoline from Chevron stations.
Yeah, the other thing they might do is they can go, okay, we have the internet now, but if you pay an extra $20 a month, you can have internet plus, which is way faster.
It's a real problem now with kids in school virtually, that a lot of them just don't have the bandwidth to pay attention in school.
The literal bandwidth.
Computer bandwidth, yeah. Internet connections aren't as good, and those are poor kids. Poor kids are very rural. Kids have terrible internet connections, or in some cases, none at all, and they fall farther and farther behind in school.
I feel bad, especially for younger kids who are finally able to starting to be able to go back in small quantities in person. But I mean, imagine trying to teach a second grade class over Zoom. Like, those kids aren't listening at all.
I mean, I do Zoom shows as a comedian, and it took comedians, you know, probably 6 months to figure out how to work the medium, because with the time delay, there's about a second time delay on Zoom, and it really screws up timing. Because if you think about it, I tell a joke, a second goes by before you hear the joke. It's another second before your laughter gets to me. That's 2 seconds, but maybe it took you a second to laugh. That's 3 seconds. And in comedy, you sort of need a seed laughter. One person starts laughing, and then the laughter spreads throughout the audience. It could be 5 seconds before everybody's laughing. It's really hard to shut up for 5 seconds waiting for laughter. Comedians have sort of learned the medium, but teachers have enough on their plate without having to learn a totally different method of teaching, because they're doing it in front of a camera instead of in front of a classroom.
Depending on where you are, you know, a lot of college professors even are, you know, mostly relying on the students to, you know, figure everything out for themselves. Like, for example, I had some professors this semester who literally were just uploading videos of recordings of the lectures that they did last semester, so they didn't have to actually just do the lecture again.
Oh,
that's dicky. That's really dicky.
Drop their names, Max. Drop their names. This is who?
I'm not
dropping
their names.
This is Dr. Brown of which department?
After graduation, you can edit this and put it in.
Yeah, after I graduate and I can't be kicked out of school.
Isn't there a Rate My Professor thing that every school has?
There is a website called Rate My Professor, but I've found that it's not typically an accurate portrayal of the teacher. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
Oh. aren't there local reviews? Because when I was in college, there was no internet, but there was a form you filled out and somebody compiled a guide and you could read review by the guide the next semester and read the reviews of the professors.
I think the issue with the review websites is the only people that actually bothered to go on and put reviews are the really polarized people, the people who either loved the teacher or hated them. Because otherwise, you don't really have, if you don't have that much of an opinion on it, like, you're not going to go out of your way to write a review on them.
But that's every review. If you go to Yelp, everything is pretty much one or five stars.
You never really see a three-star review where they go, yeah, it was good. There are a few things I didn't like about it, but overall recommend. I mean, it's either horrible, offended me, or amazing, changed my life.
Oh, I got a review on Yelp for a comedy show, and the guy wrote something like, oh my God, this is the most fun I've ever had. The show is fabulous. I recommend everybody go to see the show. It was super. I'm so glad I went. 4 stars. And I wrote to the guy and I'm like, what the hell? And he's like, I gave you 4 stars. I'm like, are you new to the internet?
That's not how that works.
It's 105, dude. 105. Mm-hmm. Get with the program.
Right. I mean, if he said, you know, there were 3 comics in the show. 2 were really funny. 1 was, you know, okay. Then a 4-star review made sense, but he just raved about everything and then 4 stars. Like, that's insane.
Do you let the online comments affect you at all?
I have very few Yelp reviews, so, you know, a few dozen. So, and they're almost always good. I had a bad review on, I forgot, it was not on Yelp, but it was on some other service from a few years ago. And it was a review of my company. But what he was complaining about was out of my control, and this was a service where I could not comment. So complaining, like, 2 stars, I didn't like the way the tickets were sold, and the seats were uncomfortable, and I paid extra for good seats, and then they let all the people from the bad seats come down and sit in the good seats for free, and I think that was horrible. Like, that had nothing to do with me, and I couldn't defend myself. But I don't allow comments on YouTube just because I don't want to hear people angry.
I mean, the people who are making comments on YouTube aren't the sort of people who you would listen to their advice about in general, you know, if you could see them.
Well, I have a colleague, Tony Deo, who's got a great bit about how he was on television, it was his dream, and the reviews were like, why do you go to YouTube and open the comments just to crush somebody's dream? Why would you do that? But here's the thing. Last month, I was on the Wendy Williams show. Virtually. And she has a segment called Date Wendy, where she invited guys to send in a video. If you're Googling Wendy Williams, maybe I should tell your audience. Okay. Wendy Williams has a TV talk show in the daytime, and it's mainly celebrity gossip based. So if you need to know what her thoughts are on the Kardashians, you can turn on the TV and watch it. And she'll have, you know, musicians and actors and stuff like that. So she had a segment called Date Wendy because she's newly single, and I sent in a video. And I was one of the 9 finalists where they ran the video, and she made comments about it. And the comments were like half positive and half negative, like, oh, I think he's just doing this for publicity, and he's old enough that he should have been married by now. And like, but he's funny, and it might be fun to date somebody funny. And she puts her shows on YouTube. So even though this was a month ago, I went on YouTube yesterday to read the comments, and there's 1,000 comments on that episode. 200,000 people watched the show on YouTube. And this was on President's Day, so she probably got more because more people were home from work or not working. But I read the comments, and most of the comments were about, you know, the guests on the show, about the Gorilla Glue woman who accidentally glued her hair to her head, and about the celebrity guests she had. But there were a bunch of comments about me, and they were favorable. And I'm like, hey, this is great. I thought I was going to get bashed. But most of the comments were like, oh, that guy's really funny. She should date him. And I was thrilled. And I'm like, this was a mistake, though. Not to get a swelled head, but because it could just as easily have gone the other way. And there's no reason to read people telling you suck.
Unless you're someone who sucks so bad that you just need to understand that you suck.
If you suck so badly, you'll never believe that you suck.
And people who make those comments have a lot of encouragement to exaggerate too. Because, you know, the only form of measurement they get on whether their comment did well is how many likes it gets or whatever. And they want to, you know, if they just typed some boring run-of-the-mill comment, they're not going to get that much traction on it. But if they say something outlandish or outrageous, they might get pushed to the top of the comment section.
Right. And also, more people respond to them. And if they're, you know, they're trolling, They say something negative, so people will argue with them. They're like, ha ha, I made those people angry.
Definitely. We had this debate recently because we were talking about the video portion, how we're starting to record video for the podcast. And then we were talking about starting to post that to YouTube and whether we should allow comments or not. And I was saying that I think we should allow comments because there might be some negative stuff and there might be a lot of trolling and things like that. But there's also going to be, that's also going to be the main platform where fans do reach out for positive things and give feedback and things like that. And so I thought it was going to be worth it to turn it on. But there's a lot of negative stuff all over the internet and you have to be really careful about how you perceive it. But it's really hard to, if you read a comment saying you suck, to not take it personally.
If it just says you suck, you can say that guy's an asshole. If somebody said, you know, Max's eyebrows are way better than Piers's eyebrows, you're going to be like, wait a minute, what's wrong with my eyebrows? And it's a stupid thing. You know, I can't believe he's got no art on his walls. Or what a stupid poster in the background. What yeah. is he, five? You know, that's the kind of thing you're going to hear.
Definitely. It's a lot. And it's hard to not take it personally when you see it.
Oh, I have a hate mail story to tell you.
Oh, tell us.
Do tell.
So when I started out as a comedian, I've been doing comedy for maybe 2 years. I got a nasty email anonymously saying, you know, you suck. I know you think you're funny, but you're terrible. And everybody thinks they're laughing at you. They're not laughing with you because you're so terrible.
That's horrible.
And if going to open mics is your entertainment, that's fine, but you'll never make a career out of this. And I'm like, what an asshole. And I tried to figure out who it was because...
How long was it?
I think that was pretty much it.
Okay.
It wasn't like 4 pages. But I tried to figure out who it was thinking, well, I only did like one open mic this week. So it was one of the people at this open mic or maybe 2 open mics. And they're open mic nights in New York. Some of them you sign up in advance and you get an email as to the lineup. So I'm looking through thinking, which one of these people would it be? And I narrowed it down. I went to one person. I said, did you send me an email? And he's like, what are you talking about? I said, I got hate mail. I think you sent it. And he looked at me and he said, Sean, I think you're a friggin' idiot. And I'll tell you in person. I don't need to do it anonymously. And I'm like, okay, it wasn't him. I realized, yeah, this is somebody who's quiet and angry. And a couple of years later, I got another email from the same email address that basically said the same thing.
Really?
And yeah, and I'm like, I think I know who this might be, but I sent the, and it was for, I think it was from Hotmail. And if he'd used Gmail, it would have been harder. But Hotmail, you can see in the header to the email, the IP address where it was sent from. So I sent that. Yeah, I didn't know this. My brother's an internet guy, and I sent it to him. And he's like, okay, this is the IP address. Here's the company it was sent from. And I'm like, that's who it is. It's a small company and I know who sent it. And I realized I had started booking comedians like within a year of starting stand-up comedy before I was good enough to get paid, but I was working with people who are good. And he'd applied to work with me and I turned him down. And I'm always polite. I always say, you know, you're not ready yet, but keep at it. Check with me in a year. And I guess he thought, I'm funnier than Sean. Why the hell is he booking comics when I'm funnier than he is? And of course, my answer is, I expect everybody in the show to be funnier than I am because otherwise, what do I need them for? I'll just do more of me. Yeah. So I agonized because now I knew who it was and he didn't know I knew who it was. And I spoke to a couple of friends about it and one of them had a brilliant suggestion. She said, create an anonymous email address, cut and paste his email from the one he sent you and send it to his regular email address. The exact same words, but from an anonymous email address. Because one, that tells him you know who it is.
Ah.
And two, he can't respond to you because that's admitting he did it. And so that's what I did. And then he dropped out of comedy soon after and haven't heard from him since.
Oh, that's genius.
You got him to drop out of comedy? That's hilarious. Yeah.
Wait, he dropped out of comedy?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people drop out. I don't think it caused him to drop out, but he's done. I don't have to see him anymore.
He saw your email. He's like, I'm done. I can't. I'm out.
He receives the email and suddenly, oh, I'm out.
Yeah, it wasn't that. So Pierce just left. What's going on there? Did we drive him out of podcasting?
I think he was just committing to the bit.
It works better when you have video. This is all audio.
Yeah, it does. Now, another thing I like to ask our guests on this podcast is because I'm a film major, I like to watch a lot of stuff. What have you been watching lately? Any recommendations? Anything cool?
You know, I've been watching way too much TV like everybody. I've been watching a lot of comedy specials on Netflix when I work out. So if I'm home riding a stationary bicycle, I'll watch Netflix stand-up comedy specials, which I didn't do much of before this, unless it was somebody I really wanted to see. But it's been very interesting watching people that I don't know or work with regularly. And I've been watching a dumb cop show from probably 7 or 8 years ago, Rizzoli and Isles, which is about two female cops in Boston. Well, a female cop whose best friend is the medical examiner and some other cops and her mother. And that's been entertaining enough to hold my interest. And then the usual shows that I just watch, The Simpsons, Law and Order, SVU. But nice. There's been nothing that's jumped out at me. And of course, I have to say, The Wendy Williams Show, watch it religiously. Wendy, change your mind. You should go on a date with me.
Of course. Wendy Williams Show is the greatest show of all time.
Everyone go tweet at Wendy Williams. You should date Sean Eli.
Yeah.
That's fine with me.
Tell her that she made the wrong decision.
Yeah.
She picked a guy to date. I don't know whether she's ever dated him or whether she just briefly mentioned it. Because when I fast forward, I'll only know she's talking about him if his picture shows up. So she might have mentioned it, or she might have said, you know what? Dating is private. I don't want to talk about it on the show.
Yeah.
Or maybe she hasn't dated him yet.
There's a chance it could have been, you know, just a fake thing that they did, you know, for entertainment on the show.
No, Wendy Williams would never do that. The institution that is Wendy Williams. She would never go do that. Her real soulmate is still out there.
Well, she knows where to find me.
Well, if she knows where to find you, can you tell our audience where to find you?
Ah, that is a great question, and I'm thrilled you asked because I have an answer for that. My website is brainchampagne.com. And if you spell it wrong, that means you're not drinking enough champagne, or you have no brain if you get the word brain wrong. Although I shouldn't say that. I'm sure there's people, English isn't their first language, and they could get it wrong. But if it is, and you can't spell brain, and you're over 8, it's B-R-A-I-N. And I picked a memorable URL because most comedians' URLs are just their name, .com, and nobody remembers their name, but people remember something that rhymes. And on my website, there's two, aside from comedy videos, there's two things that are, I think, useful. One is I send out a monthly email with original comedy material and stories from the world of stand-up. And a link to this podcast will be in my next one. And you can sign up for those emails for free, and I don't share emails with anybody. And the second thing is there's, in addition to videos, 50,000 words worth of jokes on my website. And 50,000 words is more than half of an average novel.
Wow.
That's so impressive.
There's a lot of jokes on my website, and it's all free.
Wonderful.
That's amazing.
Wonderful. Well, officially endorsed by the Secret Bunker podcast. Everyone go.
Thank you.
Brain Champagne.
Oh, I got, when I trademarked Brain Champagne, and I got a nasty letter from the champagne people in France because it's a defined term according to law, meaning sparkling wine made from grapes. And so they told me I had to withdraw the trademark. They're going to sue me. And I wrote back very politely and I said, I love champagne. That's one of the reasons it's in my URL. I love your product, but you're off base here. Nobody is going to confuse a guy telling jokes to drunks in a bar with the greatest product known to man. And I can tell you this because I've never been in a comedy club that sold a lot of champagne. And by the way, you guys kind of screwed up because your trademark is on sparkling alcohol made from grapes. So in theory, I could make sparkling wine from cherries and call it champagne. I would never do that. But the fact is, I could. And I wrote, I mean, I'm describing this, and there's a link somewhere on my website to this letter. I wrote a humorous letter pointing out how silly their argument was. And I never heard from them again.
They quit comedy too.
Yeah, right.
If you send them an email, then please don't send us an email because I don't want to quit the podcast game. Yeah.
Exactly. I think I made a French guy named Terry quit the practice of law.
How did you do that?
I sent him a letter basically saying, you're nuts. It wasn't anonymous though. I sent it. He knew who I was.
Definitely. Nice.
Taking down big champagne, big corporate champagne, one email at a time.
Taking down corporate champagne for the little guy. Yeah. Well, Sean Eli, brainchampagne.com. Thank you so much for coming on the Secret Bunker podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. You're welcome back anytime. We're at your disposal. And thank you so much for listening.
Thanks. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate the opportunity. And I hope you guys get out of your bunkers pretty soon.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed, right?